enjoy his adventurous stories. In fact, I've even shared these stories with my friend Gia.
The stories that Arna has told me are much like my school textbooks. They always have a moral. Of course, his stories are more fun. Listening to Maharaj, the morals seem more doable. I would like to thank Krishna and Maharaj for always blessing all of us and bringing joy to every life that they touch.
Born as Richard Slavin in Chicago, Maharaj's spiritual journey began at the age of 19 while on a summer trip to Europe. This resulted in the search for something more in life.
Penniless, he hitchhiked through Greece, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and finally came to India.
Here, he lived as a wandering ascetic among the forest-dwelling Himalayan yogis.
And later, amongst a wide variety of gurus and spiritual leaders throughout India and Nepal.
I would now like to call upon my mother to welcome Maharaj.
Thank you, Gia and Arna. Good evening, friends. It's with sheer delight that I welcome His Holiness Sri Radhanath Swami and each of you to this evening at our home. We are very, very blessed and grateful to have you all here with us. In addition to what Arna and Gia just mentioned, I wanted to highlight a few more things about Maharaj, as we call him.
Apart from being the spiritual light and leader of ISKCON, he is a prolific writer and a mesmerizing speaker. He has also directed a number of acclaimed social action projects, including the midday meal program which ISKCON runs for underprivileged school children, establishing missionary hospitals, eye camps, eco-friendly farms, schools, an orphanage, ashrams, and many emergency relief projects. But above all, I think to many of us in this room, he has been a spiritual guide. His first book, The Journey Home, is an extraordinary memoir, weaving a colorful tapestry of adventure, mysticism, and love. It follows the journey of Richard Slavin from the suburbs of Chicago to the caves of the Himalayas as he transforms from a young seeker to a world-renowned spiritual leader. His recent book, The Journey Within, is a New York Times bestseller. I'm sure we will have similar raving reviews when the same is launched in India. It's going to be soon launched here. In this book, he draws from his personal experiences to demystify the ancient devotional path of bhakti. He simplifies spiritual concepts like what is love, what is the soul, who is God, how can we live in the physical world without losing touch with the spiritual world. Today, we request Maharaj to shed light on how to answer some of these vital questions. Before we start, I will request my brother-in-law, Sanjayji, who has come all the way from Patna for this program, to welcome Maharaj by offering him a garland. I also want to welcome, some of the people who have helped us in this spiritual journey. And I would especially like to mention Gaurang Prabhu, who is here with us today. He's like family to us, and he's been serving at the ISKCON Chaupati Temple, as well as leading the Govardhan Eco Village project. Radha Krishna Das Prabhuji, who runs ISKCON's Anamrita, one of the largest midday meal programs feeding 1.2 million school children. And, some people, Maithili Auntie, I can't see her. Nupur, Kushal, who are our very, very dear friends and who are here today. We first met Maharaj under the moonlight, as he always remembers, at their home. And Maharaj, thank you very much for blessing us and giving us the opportunity to hear you. We are glad that you could make it in spite of your poor health today, and our gratitude for that. We are all now ears for you. Thank you very much.
Jnantimidandasya Jnananjana Chalakaya Chakshurun Milidham Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Bandeham Sri Guru Sri Yudha Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakanvitam Scha Ye Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Kopesha Gopika Kanda Radha Kanda Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Deve Pranamami Hari Priye Vanshakalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patithanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hari Hari
I am truly grateful, honored, and very happy to be with all of you this evening. Thank you for being with us. Special thanks to Sunil and your wonderful, wonderful family for welcoming all of us here. Outside in the lobby, Sunil was introducing me to many of you. I was feeling very small because physically I'm very small. As far as my bank account and investments, I'm nil, I'm nothing. As far as my education, I don't have so much academically. And to see people who have all of these things and such great responsibilities to society, who are so refined, so gentle, so cultured, and who are willing to spend their time on a spiritual event like tonight, I was very impressed. And I could understand how time is so precious to all of you. The time we have in our life, every day that we have the opportunity to live, is one of the greatest treasures that God gives us. To recognize that, to appreciate, and to reciprocate with gratitude for the gift we're given is what makes life meaningful. When we rise in the morning, we have 24 hours in our day. That equals 1,440 minutes. How precious is that time? In the morning, when we recognize the day ahead of us, we should know that whoever we are, we still have the same amount of minutes in a day. Whether we're rich or poor, educated or uneducated, whether we're from one caste or another caste, whether we're from the East or the West, we still have the same 1,440 minutes in a day. And we can't change that. Even very wealthy people, with all the money they have, they cannot extend a day for even 1 minute. Even the greatest scientists cannot make an invention to extend the day for 1 hour. And even the world's most successful investors cannot put time of a day in some investment to be utilized at another time. Time is mystical. It's inconceivable. Time cannot be seduced by beauty, cannot be bribed. Even great militaries cannot check its progress. And yet it's invisible. It's so subtle. We can't see it, we can't taste it, we can't touch it. But it's in the process of burning out the sun, making every Himalayan mountain, Sahyadri mountain, into powder, drying up the oceans and the rivers. And this earth is just going to be pulverized by time in due course. What to speak of these little bodies we have? There's a beautiful verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam that with every rising and setting of the sun, whoever we are one day closer to death. But then it gives hope. It says, for those who utilize their time for a spiritual purpose, with every rising and setting of the sun, we are one day closer to eternal life. I heard a story. There was a management teacher, and he was trying to give his students an understanding of the importance of prioritizing time. He had a jar, quite a big jar, with a wide mouth. And he had a couple bags, And from one bag, he took some medium small rocks and filled the jar to the top with the rocks. And he asked his students, "Is there room for any more?" And they all very loudly with conviction said, "No, the jar is full." Then he took another bag. It had gravel, little pebbles. And he poured the gravel, and so much gravel was going in between the rocks. And then he took the jar and started shaking it. All the gravel came to the bottom. He put more and more and more gravel in till it went to the top. He asked the students, "Is there room for any more?" They said, "No, it's impossible." Then he took another bag with fine sand and was able to pour a lot of sand in that jar. And then he shook it and went to the bottom and he put more and more and more. He asked, "Is there room for anything else?" At this time, they were silent. They didn't know what he was going to do next. He had a jar of water. He started putting water in it until it filled to the top. And the teacher asked the students, "What is the lesson that I'm trying to tell you about time through this?" And one of the students raised their hands and said, "It means however busy our schedule is, we could always fit in more." Teacher said, "But I want to tell you the real lesson. The real lesson is how we prioritize our time. If we put the gravel and the sand and the water in first, there would be no space for the rocks. What comes first? What is most valuable in your life? What gives our life meaning? What gives our life purpose? What gives us true happiness? Spending time with our families, doing good for other people, connecting with our own eternal soul, connecting with God, realizing the love that's within our heart, and through acts of compassion to share that love with others. That is a meaningful life. That is what actually brings happiness and fulfillment. Things can give some fleeting pleasure to the mind and to the senses of the body, but they can bring no fulfillment to the heart. Only love, to love and to be loved, brings fulfillment to the heart. And the origin of that love is our love for God and God's love for us. The Bhagavad Puran tells when you water the root of the tree, that water naturally extends to every part of the tree. The leaves, the branches, the flowers. And similarly, when we connect to that love that's within ourselves, it naturally extends toward appreciation of the gifts of our beloved, which is nature, the whole world. We don't want to exploit the resources God gives us. We want to honor them. Environmental sensitivity is not just to leave the world a better place for our children and grandchildren, but it's inseparable from truly, honestly following the process of religion or yoga to honor what God has given us. We all breathe the same air. what is my right to disturb the breathing of another person? We all drink the same water. We all grow our foods in the same soil. And Gita tells, Sarva yone shukonti amurtiya samavantiya tasam brahma mahajoni raham bija pratapita. Krishna tells that all living beings of every species of life, of every classification of humanity, whatever our religion, whatever our caste, whatever our race, whatever our nationality, we're all born of material nature. And Krishna tells, I am the seed-giving father. When we understand who we are, the eternal soul, the living force within this body, Vasamsi Janani Yathabihaya, the Gita tells that this body is a garment. Now, just because your clothes are covering you, it doesn't mean you should let your clothes get dirty and neglect them. And similarly, this body, it's a sacred gift of God to keep clean, to keep healthy, and to utilize for a meaningful purpose. The body becomes very sacred when it's perceived in relationship to the soul. Najayate mriyate vakadachit. Gita tells that the living force, the Atma, is never born and never dies. It's eternal. And its true potential is its nature. Why is it that anandamayobhyashat, everyone in this world is ultimately looking to be loved and love? And different types of people are trying to find that experience directly or indirectly in so many ways. Because that's the nature of the soul. To feel God's love and to be an instrument of that love in whatever we do. Whether we're little swamis, monks, or whether we're in politics, government, whether we're bankers, musicians, farmers. Samsidir haditoshana. Whatever our occupation, whatever our social status, the success of it is we use it in a meaningful, purposeful way, a way that pleases the divine. And then we naturally become pleased. And then we have the power to really make others happy. This managing teacher, he told his students that the rocks represent the important things in life. If we fill our time and fill our life with the gravel and sand, the less important things, there's no space left for what's really meaningful. We have to make our priorities. If through what we're doing, we don't have this purposeful spiritual meaning to our life, then our life, it's just all about sand and gravel. There's no real substance. And this is what great spiritual teachers and philosophers have been telling humanity since the beginning of time. How to utilize our time in such a way that at the inevitable time of death, when that moment comes, we don't say to ourselves, "What did I do?" Rather, we will feel, "Oh, what I did." Nasato vidyate bhavo na bhavo vidyate sha. The Bhagavad Gita explains what is eternal has the truest, highest value. And what is coming and going, flickering, they have the same value if they're seen in relationship to what is eternal. Otherwise, not much value at all. This book that we have just recently written, and I was asked to speak something about it, is called The Journey Within. The greatest purpose in our life is connecting to the eternal soul, connecting to the Paramatma, the Supreme Soul, being an instrument of the love of the soul in whatever we do. There's a simple story that I like to share because my dear friend is from Patna and I was speaking to him just a few minutes ago. I was wondering what to talk about tonight. And when I heard he was from Patna, I was thinking, I will talk about Patna. I hope you enjoy this little narration. In 1971, I lived in Patna, as was explained by these wonderful young girls. When I was not much older than you, I hitchhiked from London to Himalayas, through Europe, through the Middle East. And I was riding on third-class trains. And at one time from the Himalayas, my visa was expiring soon, and I was told I could easily get a visa extension in Nepal. So, have you ever rode a third-class train in India in the 1970s? I was really enjoying India's culture in that time, because I had no money. And I remember the first time I got on an Indian train, one gentleman, I met him. It was my first day in India. He said, "I want to take you somewhere." So I said, "Yes, yes." And he said, "We'll go on train." And I was thinking, train? This is incredible. You know, I traveled from London through Europe all the way through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, all the way to the Himalayas. And I was standing on dusty roads like this. Sometimes a truck would pick me up. Sometimes an overcrowded bus would just let me in. Sometimes I was in the back of camels. And he's gonna let me ride on a train with him. So I was really expecting a very restful, luxurious experience for the first time in about 6 months. In those days, they were locomotive steam engines, and I heard the train comes in, and the whistle's blowing, and all of a sudden, everyone on the railway platform, there were hundreds, they started running as fast as they can alongside the moving train. And while the train was moving still quite fast, they were throwing their bags in a window and then jumping in after that. It really looked dangerous. Jumping in a window of a fast-moving train and they're
trying to get in somehow or other, and people in the, inside the window were pushing them out. And my friend said, run! And he started running. I started running. I didn't know what was going on. And then he jumped through a window. And he said, jump! But he was gone, like a couple cars had already passed, and he was screaming at me, jump or you'll never get in. So I jumped, and I was hanging on. There were no bars in the windows in those days. It was just the window, and I was looking down, and the wheels were right under me. And somehow or other, I struggled and squirmed and got inside. And by the time I got inside, there were hundreds and hundreds of people in this railway car. There was no space for anyone else to fit. But do you know the good part of that? That included conductors and ticket takers. They couldn't get in, it was impossible. So everyone rode for free. There was a price, but not in rupees. The price was you don't get to sit down. But I saw people laying in the luggage racks. And everyone else was crushed like this. So somehow or other, I got in that luggage rack. And what is valuable? Value is not what a thing is, but how you appreciate it. After being crushed in this train for some time, for hours, I saw someone get down from the luggage rack, and I immediately climbed into it, and I had to, you know, condense my body as tight as I could to fit there. And I remember looking down at everybody else, thinking, this is luxury. How fortunate I am. How God is so merciful to me. After what I was been through, I was so tired from standing hour after hour being in that luggage rack. I can tell you, I was happier than someone living in the royal suite of a 7-star hotel in Dubai. But to speak of Mumbai, it couldn't get better than that for me. The value of something is our personal experience of it. It's not the price. So anyways, I got on a third-class train. It was always like that. But usually I didn't have the luxury of a luggage rack. I was just crushed in the main area. But I was trying to get to Nepal, and my train stopped in Patna. That was the end of the line. And I heard the Ganges was there. And I loved Mother Ganga from the Himalayas and from Varanasi. So I asked someone at the railway station, where is Ganga? And they pointed. So I walked and walked and walked, and it was late at night. I got to the bank of Ganga about midnight. And I just rolled up in a little ball. It was during, this was the monsoon season too, if I remember. And I lay down. The Ganga was so wide during the monsoon season. And I went to sleep. And oh, how luxurious that was. I had the whole bank to myself. There was a few scorpions and snakes every now and then, but you know, they're nice. I just lay down. And then morning came. And when I woke up, there was a sadhu who was standing over me. He was in his 80s. He had long white hair, long white beard. He had robes of a sadhu. He was just looking at me. He was smiling, and I looked up at him, and he started talking in Hindi, and I didn't know Hindi. So I just went, Namaskar, and he went, Jai Shri Ram. And he looked so hospitable. It was like he was there to greet me, and he asked me to come with him. And there was this little stone temple that only had two walls and little murtis of Sitaram, Lakshman, and Hanuman. And his name was Ram Sevak Swami. And this place was the collectory cut in Patna. And he didn't know how to talk English, and I didn't know his language, but he was so kind. There was a communication heart to heart that was, it made more sense than most people I can talk to. He cared about me. I was 19 years old, just turned 20, I think. He was about 85, and he was like a grandfather. Here's this little foreign sadhu who had the same kind of robes as him, and I also had matted hair. And he said, and he's just living on the river, let me take care of him. And after some time, one of his disciples came. He worked for the government, but he was retired. His name was Narayan Prasad. And he was about 81 years old himself, but he spoke fluent English. So he would translate between me and Ram Sevak Swami. And we became really good friends. And I remember one day, another sadhu came to visit. This particular sadhu, he had long, long matted hair that he tied like in above his head. And he only wore one little kopan, loincloth that looked really old, and he would never dress any other way. And I remember we were sleeping on some rocks just near the temple. And they were sound asleep, and I was laying there. There was constant mosquitoes, really hungry mosquitoes, extremely enthusiastic. They were everywhere. They were covering my body. And I was taught by sadhus, you're not supposed to kill anyone. So I wouldn't do any. I just tried to brush them away, but it was impossible. So there's no way I could sleep. I was being attacked, and I was just laying there. And I looked over at Ram Sevak Swami and this other sadhu, and their body was covered with mosquitoes just like mine. And the mosquitoes were, you know, they were real thin when they landed, and then they'd get really fat and fly away. And they were with smiles on their face, sleeping. I was thinking, how did they do that? And I remember, I hope someday I could become like them, where I could sleep even when mosquitoes are biting me. They're so peaceful, they're so self-satisfied. Or I guess they've been living like this for so many decades that they're accustomed to it. The next day, that visiting sadhu, do you like this story? There's a lesson at the end. This visiting sadhu, he went out to beg, and he made a little fire next to our little temple, and he started cooking khichdi. He had some rice, he had some dal, he got some water from the Ganga. And he was serving us after he offered them to Lord Ram. He was so happy, prasad, prasad. And it was just a couple sadhus sitting on the floor with leaf plates, and he had a bucket with a ladle, and he poured the ladle full of this khichdi on my plate. And I looked down. I think for every grain of rice, there was one chili pepper. The first bite, it was like fire. It was incredible. It was unbelievable. It was... In America, I never ate a chili pepper before. I didn't even know what they were. But my mouth was literally on fire. It's, my nose was running, my eyes were crying. It felt like the wax in my ears was melting. It was pain, it was suffering. It was torture. But I learned living with sadhus that when you're with sadhus and a sadhu cooks for you, you're not allowed to leave anything on your plate. It's an aparad, it's an offense to God. That's what I was taught. So, you know, I didn't want to do that because they were all looking at me. I was kind of representing my country too. And there's no way I was going to tell the sadhu who was so proud and so happy to feed me that I hated what he prepared. With my fingers I was eating, every bite was unbearable. My only goal in life at that time, I forgot all the goals in life I was striving to. I hitchhiked all the way from London. I got the cheapest plane possible for $60 round trip from New York to Iceland and then to Luxembourg. And I went through 6 months of really difficult things to try to get to the Himalayas because I was seeking a goal in life. My purpose was to find God, to find spiritual truth, to become liberated, enlightened, to learn how to truly love and be compassionate in this world. I was so obsessed with that goal that I left behind my whole life in America. I was a college student. She really feels sorry for me. It's nice to have somebody who sympathizes. But I left everything because I was just so obsessed. I have to find this purpose in life. And what happened is I broke the hearts of my mother and father. Which I love. They love me, I love them. I didn't want to hurt them. But I had to seek my goal in life. And here I am sitting in the floor with these sadhus, sitting on rocks. And I forgot all my goal in life. My singular goal in life was to finish the khichdi. Vyavashayatmaka buddhya rekeha kuru nandana bahushaka hirantascha buddhayo vyavashayanam. The Bhagavad Gita says, those who are on this path are resolute in purpose, their aim is one. The minds of those who are irresolute is many branched. So I actually was really close to that, but not for the right reason. So somehow or other, I finished my khichdi. And the sadhu came by with the bucket and a big ladle.
to give me more. And I was horrified. He was like Yamaraj. And I looked in that ladle and there was so many chili peppers there. And you have to eat the chili peppers too when you're with sadhus. And I said, Puran, Puran. That means I'm full. I don't need any more. And he said, Tora, Tora. And I said, Puran, Puran. And I put my hands covering the plate so he couldn't drop that ladle. And he said, Tora, Tora. And I said, Puran, Puran. And he said, Tora, Tora. And I was begging, pleading, I was crying. He thought I was just being humble. He was thinking, he's a sadhu, he loves my khichdi, but he just doesn't want to show that he eats too much. But I have to feed him and make him happy. And I couldn't explain. So I was, no, no, please. And he poured it. And all the other sadhus were just eating it very happily, talking about Ram Katha while they're eating and smiling. And I'm crying, and my mouth was on fire, my body was on fire, perspiring profusely. And finally, I finished it. And he came by with the bucket. Tora, Tora. I don't think I could have lived through a third one. And I was covering it with my hands, but that didn't matter. Once it starts coming down, your hands can't cover it. And he was just about to pour another one. And I prayed. You know, I worship God in many different forms in my life with many different names. And every name and every form that I was praying to all of them. Please save me. I can't do this. And then I got a good idea. And I believe it was Ishwara Sarvabhutana. Hridayasarjana Chishtati Bhagavad Gita says that the Paramatma, Krishna in the heart, gives us intelligence. He directs us. If we're sincere, and I was pretty sincere that day. So just when he was about to pour it, I took my leaf plate and crumpled it up until he couldn't put anything on it. And then he smiled and went on to the other sadhus, and they took ladle after ladle after ladle. And meanwhile, I was still crying. It's just because that was the effect. And that sadhu, I could understand what he was saying in Hindi to the other ones. He said, just see this boy, he's so saintly that he's crying out of affection because he likes my khichdi so much. And I went, yes, you know, that's what happened. And as I was sitting there, I was thinking, what is the lesson I'm learning here at Collectory Ghat with these sadhus in Patna? The lesson was, sometimes to honor and please someone, it takes sacrifice. It's a higher purpose. To be tolerant, to be forgiving, for another person's happiness. I made him so happy. He was so proud because he thought I was crying in ecstasy. And amazing, 46 years later, it's as if it's happened this morning. And that lesson has become one of the foundational principles of my life. How to accept inconveniences for the well-being and happiness of other people.
it's very much molded my character. It's a foolish little story, but not for me. But I'm going to tell you that night, not a single mosquito bit me. I think my blood was too spicy for them. One time, Narayan Prasad, he took me to meet his best friend, who owned the Magadha X-ray clinic. His name was Muhammad, and he was of the Islamic faith. Narayan Prasad, from his birth, was a enthusiastic, devoted follower of bhakti, specifically to Lord Ram. Everything in his life was talking about Ram and Sita. And every day for hours and hours, he would tell me stories. So we went to this X-ray clinic, and his friend, it was lunchtime, he closed it down, and we didn't eat lunch, we just sat together. And the two of them shared, in English, their spiritual realizations. And they had total respect for each other. They honored each other. They listened to each other. And they'd asked me to share my ideas. And I spoke some whatever little I was learning. And we did that for several days. And one day when Narayan Prasad and I were sitting alone on the bank of the Ganga at the collectory ghat, I asked him, India is a place where there's a lot of communal conflict between Hindus and Muslims. How is it that the two of you are such close friends and you have such deep appreciation and respect for your faiths? I'll never forget his answer. I've cited it hundreds of times over the years. He said, if a dog likes his master, he will recognize his master in whatever way the master dresses. The master will come in with suit and tie, may come in with robes, maybe just underwear. The master might not be wearing any clothes at all, but the dog will recognize this is my master. He said, if God comes to someone in a different form with a different name, there's one God. If we don't recognize that God, then we are lower than that dog. And later on, I was studying Bhagavad Gita. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chutuskritam dharma samstapanarataya sambhavami juge yuge. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. Abhyutanama dharmasya tadatma namasrajamya. This was one of the most beautiful things that transformed my life. This wonderful Vedic religion accepts that the one Supreme Being has descended into this world throughout history in many ways, in many forms, with many names, to show compassion to all living beings. And I studied many religions, but this makes so much sense because I saw so much hatred and so much arrogance and so much persecution. And I was born in a minority religion in the West, and people hated me. People misused me. abused me because of that. And I always wondered, if there's one God, why are they like this? And Bhagavad Gita, Vedic literatures, give such a deep, profound, inclusive understanding of God. And these are lessons I learned on the bank of Mother Ganga in Patna. Anandamayo Vyashat is from the Brahma Sutra. It means everyone is ultimately looking for pleasure. Everyone's looking for happiness. The little baby, when it comes out of the mother's womb, why does the baby cry? Because the baby wants to be happy. It's not that the baby just wants milk. Yes, the baby wants to be fed. But for a little child, that's the interaction where a baby can recognize love. When they're in need and the mother comes to feed them. The milk of the mother is the mother's love for the child. Because if you don't love the child, milk's not going to come. Just recently at Govardhan Eco Village, a little calf was born. Beautiful white cow, shining, glossy, loving eyes. She was just gazing upon her little calf. And you could hear when she was mooing, you could hear it's a with pure affection. No love song could communicate so nicely as that cow who was just mooing her affection for that little calf. And the little calf was looking up at the mother. And within a few minutes, the calf jumped up on her feet and started drinking the milk of the mother. And I was right there, and I saw the mother. She heard, as she was feeding the calf. It's liquid love. That's common to people. And the human species too. So the little baby, he just wants to be loved. If we're too busy making money, if we're too busy trying to get famous, we're too busy trying to become powerful, then we don't give love to our children. They may be dressed nicely, but they live in misery. Because all they really want is to be loved. And if by giving gifts, like clothes and everything, if they feel it really is an expression of love from their parents, it makes them really happy. My mother's birthday, I stole a rose from her garden. There was only three of them. Because we had lived in a very simple little house with a very simple little garden behind it. Mother, happy birthday. I stole it from her. And I didn't even cut it, I just ripped it off. She cried in such happiness. She put that rose to her forehead, she put it to her nose, she put it to her heart. She said, thank you. If you were to give me diamonds and gold, it would not be as meaningful as this rose. Then she recited what was like her mantra through when I grew up. She said, it's never the thing that has value. It's the love in which it's shared that is what has value. Ultimately, we're seeking love. And the exchanges with our family, the exchanges with our friends, the exchanges with society, what's meaningful and purposeful is when we're receiving love and we're sharing love. And the best way to get love is to give love, because people love when we give. People never love you because of your bank account. People never love you because of your fame. People love you because of your character. You know, the praise of people for our accomplishments, it's not really from their hearts. Because if we don't accomplish much afterward, they don't care anything for us. But if we give love, and they reciprocate with love, then in whatever situation we're in, people are going to appreciate. Our children, what's the greatest thing we could give them? All over the world, there are parents that leave large inheritance to their children. And in many cases, they fight over each other. They fight over it. Is that pleasing to the parent? But rich or poor, whatever, if parents give values to their children, the value of compassion, the value of generosity, the value of integrity, by their own example, then they've given the children something that's really valuable. Giving children something that's going to make them happy and empower them to make others happy through whatever they do and whatever they may have in their life. Purposeful life. Meaningful life is about love. Why? Because that love is inherent within our heart. It's our true nature. It is the Shakti of the soul, the Atma. The relationship between every living being and the Bhagavan, Paramatma, or God, is a relationship of love. In the Bible it is said, both Old Testament, New Testament, the first and great commandment is to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And what is the expression of that love? That you will love your neighbor as yourself. And everyone's our neighbor. Mother Earth is our neighbor. The cows, the goats, the sheep, the dogs, the trees, and all of humanity. Spiritual practice is to tune in to that prema, that love that's within our heart, that ananda, that happiness that's within us. That's the most beautiful thing. And if we harmonize that eternal treasure within, with whatever we may do in our families, in our social dealings, in our occupation, then our life becomes truly meaningful. My mother's mantra was, when she took that rose, She said, it's the thought that counts. It's the love that gives everything value. And in a foolish little way, perhaps, but it's important to me, that's what empowered me to eat all those chili peppers. This sadhu was showing me love and to reciprocate. And it's a very meaningful thing to me even today. He blessed me profusely. Because you see, the precious value of time, if we don't utilize it for these really meaningful reasons, to keep our appointment with God within ourselves, then our whole life is just filled with that sand and gravel. There's nothing of true substance. My beloved Guru, Srila Prabhupada, he taught us this very universal principle of bhakti. And he gave the analogy, apuryamanam achalapratishtam samudram apapravishanti advat, that the ocean is so full in itself there may be dozens and dozens of rivers simultaneously entering the ocean. During the rainy season, like in Patna, the Ganga was probably over a kilometer wide. It was almost like an ocean. You couldn't see the other bank. I don't know if it still gets like that today. But how much water in the rainy season is pouring into the ocean? And during the dry season, April, May, beginning of June, some of the rivers dry up. There's hardly any just trickling into the ocean. Is the ocean bigger or smaller due to the seasons? A little puddle of water, if you don't put anything in it, it'll dry up. If you put a lot in it, it'll really be different. But the ocean remains the same simply because it's so fulfilled within itself. So the Bhagavad Gita explains that we have so many desires in our life. And because of the dualities, happiness, distress, honor, dishonor, pleasure, pain, success, failure, victory, defeat, health, disease, the dualities of life are always changing. Whoever we are, we don't have control most times of what's going to happen. Once you get about 50 years old, you don't want to get older. When you're really a little kid, you want to get older as fast as possible. When will I grow up? When will I grow up? But my father's 94. He's not looking forward to being 95. But can anyone stop that? It's beyond our control. It doesn't matter how powerful, how many political connections we have. It doesn't matter how athletic we are. We can't stop time. So there are so many things beyond our control in this world. But there's something within our control. You see, even if in our life we have wasted so many days and so many hours and so many minutes and even so many years, still, tomorrow morning, you still have 24 hours and 1,440 minutes. And you have a choice how you're going to live it. Doesn't really matter what's happened in the past. We learn our lessons. But we have such beautiful opportunities, such beautiful blessings in whatever situation we're in. In our tradition, we chant God's names, satsang. We associate with people who enlighten our faith in these higher purposes of life. That satsang gives us inspiration and direction. Like tonight, satsang with enlightened teachers or with people who share the same inspiration spiritually as ourselves. And when we have that inspiration, sadhana. No matter how busy we are, we make priority in life our spiritual practice. To nourish ourselves, to refresh ourselves, to surcharge ourselves with this higher experience. Param drishtva nivartate. Just like however busy you are, you find time in the day to eat. Now, if you don't eat, you could probably make more money, at least for that day. But we know that by eating, we get energy to do everything with better quality. You can't do your work too well if you're starving. So similarly, when we nourish ourselves spiritually every day, we make a priority to give that time to our prayer, to our meditation, to our puja, to our study, and to our chanting, beautiful mantras. And we become spiritually nourished, spiritually strong, with a spiritual vision to take us into the day and to empower us through the day. Sadachar means to live with character, to live with integrity. And when we're living with character and integrity, then seva, then our whole life becomes a beautiful offering. And in whatever occupation we're in, practically all, we could live with that meaningful, purposeful blessing. If we just wake up in the morning and we thank God for the day we have, to make an offering, to make an offering of our sincerity, and to make a positive difference in this world. Thank you very much. I will do whatever you say. I'm sorry if I spoke too long, but he forgot to give me a time.
I'm sure we would want to keep going, but there is definitely time for a couple of questions, brief interaction. There are mics here. If anyone has any question, any thoughts, any views, anybody wants to share, the mic will reach you. You want to go? Yeah.
Maharaji, thank you. It's an absolute privilege to hear you face to face. So if you will not think me impudent, I will ask a question that's very personal and important to me. And I'm very influenced by a lot of the people who are part of ISKCON and have been guides over the years. And I do think it is the most important thing to figure out the meaning of life and God and so on and so forth and our relationship. The one big question, and I have devoted many, many years in whatever little way I can, but the one question I always get stuck on is, asking ourselves on whose authority, if it's not that impudent a question. Different religions, different leaders, most of them, I guess, trying to find the same God, as you said, sometimes preach conflicting stuff. And very often, the eventual answer to the question on whose authority is almost a tautological one, because of this book, and this book is right because God said so. And that's kind of a circular argument, if you know what I mean. So how does one sort of move past that?
I think I know what you mean. That was, what you're speaking was a dilemma that I struggled with for years. How could people hate in the name of a loving God? If there's one God who's the Supreme Father and Mother of all living beings, how can we hate anyone if they're our brothers and sisters? Just because they're from a different religion? I studied Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, and so many different varieties of Hinduism. And I found in each and every one of these spiritual paths, there were people who, to me, looked quite arrogant, condescending, even hateful toward anyone different. And everyone always has their verses from scriptures. I remember one of my God brothers told me there's different slokes for different folks. So everyone has their scriptures, everyone has their interpretations, and everyone can thump on the book and say, you see, I'm right, you're wrong. But I also met people from all these different spiritual faiths who really found in their connection to the Supreme the power to love, the power to forgive, and the power to see the essence. If we see the essence in our own spiritual path, we're going to see that essence in other true spiritual paths. If we're only seeing the rituals, the forms, the languages, and we only have a very external conception. And every spiritual path has different external languages and historical references. So we have everything to fight about. But what transformed me? I learned from my guru a beautiful statement from the scriptures, from the Vedas. Sara Grahi Janardana. That Janardana, or God, sees the essence in everything. And a devotee is Sara Grahi, is always seeking the essence. If we find that essence within ourselves, you see, you could change your religion. You could change your nationality. These days with medical technology, you could change your sex. But who am I? Who is that changeless person that's me? That's the Atma, that's the soul. Sanatan Dharma is the very essence of Hinduism. Sanatan Dharma is really the essence of all true religions. What is the Dharma, the duty of the soul eternally? It's to understand who we are, understand our relationship with God. When we learn how to love, everything changes.
You can take money and use it for the most noble, compassionate causes, or you could take money and use it for destruction. Yes? Is money good or bad? Money is as good as the person who has it. Technology. In today's world we're living in, we're promised that technology, things like computers and cell phones and Twitters and internets and Instagrams and all of these different satellite televisions with so many stations, we're told that having this will make your life simpler. Yes, you'll save time. It's like what in the old days, typewriters, remember whiteout? Or is that before you were born? Where if you wanted to change something in a typewriter, you had to get a little piece of white paper and you put it, and then you, and it goes over and whites out the letter you did, and then you type it again. Yes, so to save time, now computer, you just delete, it's gone. Now you don't even have to type, you just speak and it types itself. So people are thinking it's saving me time, and it does have the capacity to save us time. But usually what happens is, it's like a little spider web, you know, a fly just touches it and soon it's all entangled in it. How much time is wasted with internet and Instagrams and Twitters and, you know, and websites? It just takes you from one to another and another. It's one of the greatest distractions. I've even seen and talked to children, I mean parents about little children, their lives are just sometimes obsessed with all these computerized gadgets. So you see, yes, technology can save us time, but they can also really, really waste our time. And we don't even realize it until the day's done, and my God, hours went by with that. So everything could be used for a very negative purpose or a very productive, positive purpose. And the same is true for religion. The same is true for yoga or spirituality. If we're insecure and empty inside and we need to feel ourselves more better than everybody else and more powerful than anybody else, and everybody else is wrong, and the more wrong they are, the more right I am. If that's what we're looking for in life, you could find that in religion. If you're looking for the essence, if you're looking for what the true saints are telling us to find, we'll find that there. And it will give us such richness, just like that ocean. We're not depending on little rivers for our happiness, of whether our desires are fulfilled or not fulfilled. If we have shallow state of consciousness, if our desire is fulfilled, we're thinking, oh, how great. And we become greedy. And if our desire is not fulfilled, we could become very angry and very envious or even very depressed. That's because there's an emptiness there. But if we're finding that inner peace, if we take that journey within, then we don't have to hate. We don't have to be envious. We don't have to be greedy. We could live on the terms of what's truly great, and that's compassion. And in my little life, I found that true spirituality is not the theory of what we believe, but it's how we live. The theory of what we believe should actually be the foundation in how we live. Does that answer your question? So yes, at a certain point, myself, when I saw so much discrimination and so much hatred and so much arguing and so many wars, I was thinking either I have to just reject religion altogether forever, or I have to seek the essence. And to the core of my heart, I really believed that essence was there. And it is there. And it's the most precious, valuable, wonderful thing in all of creation. Because it can empower us to live with love. And to bring true happiness to others. I'm sorry, my answers are long sometimes.
Never mind. Maharaj, we'll take one more question, and I've just got a message that the prasad is getting colder. So
getting
we'll
cold.
Take one question and then we'll seek your permission to close.
Well, you could always put chili peppers in it.
So, any thoughts, anyone? Yes. You have one?
Yeah, Maharaj, in this message of love and brotherhood, how do we reconcile the messages coming from the leader of the both parties? I'm referring to Donald Trump. And executive orders being passed, visa restrictions being put on, a lot of other restrictions being put on. How do we reconcile this with the message of love and brotherhood?
Prasad's getting cold. I think I already answered that question. But what does it mean to be a powerful nation? If we look through history, so many nations have become powerful. You know, there was the Roman Empire, and there was the fall of the Roman Empire. There was the Greek Empire and the fall of the Greek Empire. The Mughal Empire and the fall of the Mughal Empire. Oh, and there was the British Empire. And the fall of the British Empire. So all these empires, you know, they usually last for some centuries. And when they're lasting, it seems like they're going to last forever. But in this world, nothing lasts forever. Everything's changing. So the most important thing is the values and the integrity in which we lead. From a spiritual perspective, we read about Yudhisthira Maharaj, Parikshit Maharaj, Ramchandra, Ambarish Maharaj, Ranti Dev. These were kings. It's interesting because so many of the stories in Mahabharata, Ramayana, Srimad Bhagavatam, Puranas are stories of kings. Ravana was a king, but he was arrogant, and he was greedy, and he was thinking about himself. Ramchandra was a king, but he was humble, respectful, considered himself a servant of every person in his kingdom. Ranti Dev, he was a king. He was fasting for the benefit of his citizens for 40 days.
for the benefit of his citizens. He was trying to get blessings by fasting with his family. And he was in a remote place in the forest, and someone came with a beautiful plate of prasad, food. He was just about to break his fast, and a Brahmin came and said, "I'm hungry." So he fed the Brahmin, and then he sat down to eat with his family. And a person came, just a dweller of the forest, who really didn't have any guest in those days, and he said, "I'm hungry." And Radhide fed his whole family, and then fed this man. Then he sat down to eat whatever was left, and a man came with a pack of dogs and said, "I'm hungry, and my dogs are hungry." And he fed all the dogs, and he fed everybody, and there was no food left. All that was left was one glass of water. And if he didn't drink that, he was on the verge of death. And when he was about to drink it, another man came, a person who had no education, no anything. He just came out of the jungle and said, "I'm thirsty." And Ranti Dev offered a beautiful prayer. He said, "My beloved Lord, I do not pray to you for fame, for power. I do not pray to you for mystic cities, yogic supernatural powers. I do not even pray to you for liberation. I only have one prayer, that whenever I take birth, and wherever I may take birth, please give me the strength to sacrifice my life for the well-being of others. By giving this water to this man, I will forever be free from thirst, hunger, anxiety, lamentation." And then he gave the water. According to the Vedic literatures, according to the core of humanity, that is leadership. We can't imitate that, but that's a standard of leadership. And somehow or other, the devas all appeared and said, "We took those forms just to show the world what a real leader is." And then they gave him a big feast, and he ate. Every single person in his kingdom was God conscious. After this, there was no poverty because everyone was so charitable to each other. Krishna tells in Gita, what leaders do, the common men, they follow. That's the standard of success. And we could understand the state of condition of a society by who are the leaders. And Ambarish, how forgiving, how kind. You see, whether it's marriage, whether it's politics, whether it's business, whether it's education, Bhaktaram jagatapasam sarvaloka maheshwaram suhridam sarvabhutanam gyatvam am shanti mirchati. Real happiness, and especially real leadership, is when we understand I am not the proprietor. Sarvaloka maheshwaram means Krishna says, I am the proprietor of everything that exists. Aham sarvasya prabhavam atta sarvam pravartate. All spiritual and all material worlds, everything is emanating from me. whatever abilities we have, whatever wealth we have, whatever influence we have, whatever intelligence we have, our bodies, everything else, they are all being entrusted to us. They are the property of God. That is human intelligence. That's beyond sectarian conceptions. That's the essence, that everything is the property of God. I am not the proprietor. I am the caretaker. My body and everything that connected to it is entrusted in my care, and a caretaker utilizes everything for a sacred purpose. Not greed, not exploitation, but seva, to serve. That's leadership. That's the leadership of a father and mother for their children. That's the leadership of a CEO for a company. That's the leadership of a professor for the students. And that's the leadership in political circles that the world needs. Examples. We care about the people we're leading. It's not about me. It's about them. And each and every one of us can become a leader, a true leader, if we live by those sacred principles. And as far as the acting president of the United States of America, we can apply these principles to him and all other leaders and then come to our own conclusions. Does that kind of answer your question? Thank you very much.
Well, Maharaj, all good things have to come to an end, so we have to close this, but it was fascinating, really, and I'm sure all of you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed it, so I'll request you to please join me in giving a big round of applause to Maharaj. Maharaj, you said a very interesting and important thing, which is, to get love, it's important to give love. And when Nupur asked me to read the manuscript of The Journey Within, there is one very similar message which came across in the book which struck with me. I want to read that. I quote, "Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love, for it is in giving that we receive," unquote. Each anecdote in the book, once you read, you'll realize, conveys a very deep meaning in the life very, very nicely. And I'll request you all to please collect a copy of your book as you leave this premises. But there's a precondition that the book will not be available to you unless until you take your prasad. So please, do not leave without taking prasad. Before we close, I just wanted to thank some people without whose support this program wouldn't have been possible. The team from the temple, the Chaupati, Radha Gopinath Temple, who organized the sound and media, Braj Kirti Prabhu, Nila Krishna Prabhu, Satya Gopinath Prabhu, Bharat Prabhu, and Shiv Sagar Prabhu. Some of them are present here. Then from the team which did a beautiful flower decoration, Purushottam Prabhu and Nihal Mataji and Mehal Mataji. Rasgopant Prabhu helped us with the books. And Jayashankar Prabhu, actually, we heard very good kirtan from him and his team. And in addition to that, of course, the team from SCON Temple, some of them I hear, they have been involved in organizing this program. Without that, it would not have been possible. Both Anubhuti and I, we are very, very grateful and really touched and blessed with your presence this evening. Thank you very much for coming, And we will really request you, sincerely request you to please receive prasad before you leave. Thank you very much. Thank you, Maharaj. Hare Krishna. Maharaj is here for some more time, so please feel free to interact with him if anybody wants to interact with him.